4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in a bit, a major report on mammograms raises a question for a lot of women. Is getting a mammogram worth it? The study's author joins us.
First, what can science fiction teach us about real-world science? Our next guest is a theoretical physicist who started digging into the science and technology of Star Trek to see what we could learn about physics.
Lawrence Krauss is the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. His books include The Physics of Star Trek. He's in Wisconsin today to speak at UW-Madison Memorial Union as part of the Distinguished Lecture Series. He's speaking tonight at 7:30.
Lawrence, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Why is a science fiction show like Star Trek a good teachable moment when it comes to science?
Well, you know, there's some research in pedagogy that suggests the only way to teach people is to confront their own misconceptions. And Star Trek and a lot of science fiction is full of misconceptions, so it's great fodder to use those ideas and surprise people.
Do you get caught up between feeling, you know, a bit scoldy, making fun of this popular culture TV show, versus taking these ideas and running with them and clarifying?
No. I mean, making fun is of anything. I try to make fun in science. Humor is a good part of teaching, it seems to me, or at least communication. But I think the real opportunity is to use it to show the truth is stranger than fiction. And therefore, it's a great opportunity, and it's a lot of fun to show people. You know, when I wrote that particular book, it was a quandary because I didn't want to say, this won't work, this won't work, this won't work. That wouldn't have been any fun. But on the other hand, I also believe if you're popularizing, you have to be extremely honest. People want something to be true, and there's great pressure to please them. And some people I know who write about science try and do that, and I'm not thrilled about that. But what I realized I could do was be honest and exciting at the same time, because I'd say, this won't work, but, you know, it's related to something in the real world that's actually more interesting. And that what a great way to be able to talk about science. In fact, that's how I decided to do the book. I was riding the train back from New York City to New Haven when I taught at Yale, and I was thinking, my editor had been joking because her daughter was a Trekker, and then I started thinking about the transporter, and I thought, how would I make a transporter? And then I thought of all the neat physics that you'd have to think about, and I was hooked.
Let's run with the transporter. It's one of the most famous, iconic things from Star Trek. What would it take to beam me somewhere?
It would take a different universe, I think, because, you know, there's a very simple law of quantum mechanics, not very simple, actually, but fundamental, which is called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which says that I can know where every atom is in your body, but I can't know what it's doing. And I mean, the way the transporter works on Star Trek is that I take you and I disassemble you into individual atoms, and I transport those atoms, and then I put them all together and make another copy of you. First of all, disassembling you would require heating you up to maybe 100 million degrees and probably releasing as much energy as 100 nuclear weapons, which
Ouch.
Isn't not environmentally friendly. I notice you're very environmentally conscious here. But aside from that, I wouldn't do it that way because I've surfed the internet and seen.
So what's the right way to?
Well,
do
you
it?
Know, I've said, for example, I've tried to download a Ferrari. I've never been able to do it, but I can download the plans for a Ferrari. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do is I'd scan you and get all the information that makes you up as a human being and send that information from here to there and then combine it with atoms I already have and make another copy of you. Now, that's not a transporter because you still exist in the first place, but then I just disassemble you and then you're only, you know, I just blow you up and then you're only over there. But the problem is it's getting that information because we cannot know where every atom is in your body and what it's doing. And if I want to exactly recreate you over there, then I have to know that. So I could make an approximation of you, but I couldn't make an exact replica. Now, would the approximation be close enough? I don't know. That's a biological question. But I know that it would be a problem. And the Star Trek writers, one of them at least, knew that. And when asked how does the, you know, they have Heisenberg compensators on Star Trek. And he was asked, how do they work? And he said, very well, thank you.
This seems like there's an ethical issue there. Once I'm over there, am I really that willing to be disassembled over here?
It would be great if it would work because we could – all sorts of interesting things like worrying about whether people have a soul. If I just take your atoms and recreate it, what happens to your soul? Of course, there is no soul. But we could prove it if we could do it. But alas, we can't. Now, Having said that, we can do that for individual atoms and photons, and there's something called quantum teleportation that's fascinating because if we have quantum states, very carefully prepared quantum states, we can do weird and wonderful things. And so people say, if we can do it for atoms and photons, why not people? Well, the point is that you're not a very carefully prepared quantum state, and just get used to it.
Another thing, and this is not just Star Trek. This is all over in science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I have a limited understanding of physics. My belief, I'll call it that, is that we can't travel faster than light. The Enterprise is always tooling around, warp speed.
Yeah. Well, you can't – you have to be a little more careful, be like a lawyer and parse a little more carefully.
Okay.
We can't travel through space faster than light, but space can do whatever the hell it wants. And we're on the radio, maybe I should say whatever the heck it wants. And so therefore space can actually carry you away faster than light because, in fact, with general relativity, you can be moving and standing still at the same time because there are distant galaxies that are now moving away from us at the speed of light. How is that possible? Well, we're at rest in our local surroundings, and they're at rest in their local surroundings too. But the space between us is expanding, so it's carrying them away like a surfer on a wave, if you wish. And therefore, in principle, general relativity allows things to separate faster than light. And unfortunately, however, to recreate that kind of condition would require a new kind of energy, which we don't even know if we could create in the lab. But even if we could, it would take more energy than there is in the galaxy to try and do it, and so NASA may appropriate funds for it, but it's not gonna happen. And moreover, by the way, just so I don't get letters from listeners later, even if we do imagine a warp drive where you're carried away by space by somehow making space expand faster than light, you still can't move from one place to another and get there from the beginning of the time you try to the end faster than light. Because in order to make space expand, you have to carefully prepare the space all the way. And that means sending things at the speed of light or slower. So you can, when it actually happens, you can go zoom. But from the time you start the experiment, you can't get from A to B faster than light. It's like catch 22, and that's the way it is again.
What about wormholes? I don't know if Star Trek ever delved into wormholes.
Of course they did.
That cheats that rule that you just said in many science fiction presentations.
Yes, it does. And Star Trek has a very famous wormhole. But at least one. But unfortunately, again, it's like catch 22 because indeed wormholes are shortcuts through space. If you imagine curving a piece of paper and then, creating a little tunnel from one end to another, if you went on the paper to go from one end of the paper to the other, you'd have to go all the way around the paper. But if you took a tunnel between the other two ends that were now close together, you'd be very close. That's what a wormhole is. It's a three-dimensional version of that. And in fact, the laws of physics say they're possible in principle. The problem is we can show, once again, if you try and create a wormhole with any normal kind of energy, then in fact, either end of the wormhole will collapse to form a black hole before you could traverse the wormhole. So there are no traversable wormholes. And in fact, the only way around that, again, is if you create that weird kind of energy that keeps the mouth of the wormhole open. And we don't know if you can create that kind of energy. So it's probably, unfortunately, unlikely. But, by the way, and maybe we don't have time to go into this, if you could create those weird kind of energy and create a traversable wormhole, you'd actually be able to create a time machine, which is much more fascinating than just going faster than light.
So my initial idea there is getting from point A to point B faster than light doesn't seem very plausible.
No, it doesn't. And I think that, our future is not even to go at light speed. If we're going to travel into the universe, we're not going to go in starships that are traveling near light speed because even that takes huge amounts of energy. We'll travel on slow ships that take many, 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 many centuries and we'll never expect to return. And you might say that's kind of sad, but then if you think about it, throughout human history, that's what humans have done when they've gone exploring. They've left one place and gone to seek another, expecting never to return. And why have they done that? Well, A, maybe adventure, or B, wherever they lived was intolerable.
Or they wanted to boldly go.
Well, they wanted to boldly go, or they've just been driven away. And maybe we'll make the Earth so miserable in the future that people will be willing to leave just to get away from the place.
I want to wrap up with the humble cup of tea that Jean-Luc Picard says, Earl Grey, hot, to the dispenser, and it, out of nothing, there is a cup of tea. Is that the most efficient way to make yourself a cup of tea?
Probably not. I think boiling water is a lot easier, and often the low-tech solution is the best one. And we love high technology, But, you know, if you wanted to do that, you might be able to create a cup of tea because it's the same kind of transporter technology, but you don't have to be as accurate, right? You don't have to make the water molecules all, you don't care if they're exactly
there's
as
no
they
internal
were
organs.
And so they're kind of like a 3D printer. You know, maybe with a 3D printer, you could somehow make a cup of tea, but it seems like overkill. It seems like cutting butter with a chainsaw.
But these things, they can make anything. The energy there must be incredible.
Well, of course, because if you're not using raw materials, you have to take enough energy to create particles. And, you know, E equals MC squared means that you need a lot of energy to make a small amount of matter. And, or turn around the other way, a small amount of matter releases a lot of energy. And so, as I say, if you have the raw materials, then rearranging them may not be impossible. And that's what we're doing with our 3D printers nowadays. We're basically taking raw materials and using just computers which store the information to create objects. And that's fascinating. And again, once again, I think the real world is perhaps more fascinating than fiction.
Fascinating stuff. Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was theoretical physicist Loren Krauss, author of The Physics of Star Trek. He's speaking at 7:30 tonight at UW-Madison's Memorial Union.
A new study on mammograms came out yesterday. Experts say it will add to the already heated debate over cancer screenings for premenopausal women. The study concludes that yearly mammograms don't have an impact on the number of cancer deaths every year. Experts don't think this will change national screening policies anytime soon, but it does add to the confusion about whether mammograms are needed every year.
Dr. Anthony Miller joins us now. He's the lead author of the study and professor emeritus in epidemiology at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Dr. Miller, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
So the New York Times today is billing your study as, quote, one of the largest and most meticulous studies of mammography ever done. It involves 90,000 women lasting a quarter century. And the results are provocative, essentially that yearly mammograms don't lower the breast cancer mortality rate for women. Walk us through this. What question were you trying to answer when you began the study?
We were, in fact, trying to find out whether mammography did lower breast cancer mortality. When we started the study, there was no really good evidence that mammography screening was beneficial for women aged 40 to 49. So we assessed that, but in conjunction with good breast examinations. But for women aged 50 to 59, the question was, how much does mammography add to good breast physical examinations? And that is the question we addressed in the older age group in our study. But we found no benefit from mammography in either age group.
How did you conduct the study?
What we did was to seek volunteers from the population. We approached a number of groups in the university and businesses. We had volunteers that called women through the population registers in various centers. In Nova Scotia, we got the assistance of those in charge of the health records to write to women. And once they attended at one of our breast screening centers, we had 15 across Canada, the women were asked, told about the study, explained that whether or not they got mammography would be decided entirely at random, and then they were asked to sign an informed consent form. And if they did so, they then were conducted to the examination room where carefully trained, specially trained nurses did the examinations. And then, no matter what was found on the examination, they then, if randomized to mammography, had the mammogram. If they were not randomized to mammography, they went home. Now, if the nurse found an abnormality in either group, they were asked to come back to be seen by the study surgeon, who would then examine them, get another mammogram, or get a mammogram in the women who hadn't been allocated mammography if he or she felt it was necessary, and then make a recommendation to the woman's family physician. So that's how we conducted the study. Then we followed them up By those who were allocated to be screened came back every year for 5 years, and then we followed them indirectly through record linkage to the cancer registries, which are collected by Statistics Canada in Ottawa, and also the National Death Index.
So it's a striking finding. The way it works in the United States right now is when a woman hits the age of 40, or sometimes 41, depending on the advice of her doctor, she trots off, she gets her mammographies every year, every other year, and this seems to be the standard practice right now. So based on what you found, would you say that maybe women don't need to do that anymore? Maybe a manual exam is enough and we're wasting our time with a mammography?
Well, I think mammography's major use is as a diagnostic test. As a screen, I think it's been very much oversold. Our study finds no benefit of using mammography. I'm not saying every woman needs to come in for an annual breast examination, but I do think it's necessary that women are aware of the fact that breast cancer can occur as they get older, more and more at risk of breast cancer. They should be aware of the structure of their own breasts. Breast self-examination is somewhat unpopular, but in fact we have other studies which show it's beneficial. They should certainly be worried if they detect any lump in their breast, either in the shower or if they detect any change in the shape of the breast when they look at themselves in the mirror. And then if they are worried, they should go and see a family physician or someone who's been trained to recognize the signs of early breast cancer. Unfortunately, still, we've got a cadre of family physicians who don't know the signs of early breast cancer. They are only signs of advanced breast cancer. And sometimes they may wrongly tell a woman nothing is wrong when something is wrong and diagnosis needs to be made.
So let's say a woman does want to be what she considers to be on the safe side and she wants to get a mammogram every year. Are there risks associated with that decision?
Well, there are two risks that women need to be aware of. The first is, and this is, many think it's not very serious, but it is that mammography often finds suggestions of abnormalities in the breast, which turn out to be nothing. This is what we call false positives. But in order to determine they are nothing, a number of other tests need to be done, ultrasound, possibly more detailed mammography, even sometimes biopsies. Now, if they're found to be normal, then most women are reassured and no harm has been done. On the other hand, what our study has particularly been able to identify because of the long-term follow-up is that there is this proportion of breast cancers found by mammography that, in fact, are not growing, or they grow so slowly that they would never have caused a problem in the woman's lifetime. And these cancers seem to comprise about 50% of the invasive cancers which are identified by mammography that cannot be found by a skilled examiner.
50%? So you're saying 50% of the cancers that a mammography might pick up might be the type or are the type that would never need treatment?
Well, I'm not quite saying that. I'm saying 50% of the cancers that cannot be found at the time mammography finds them would not need treatment. If you want to relate it to the numbers of cancers found by screening, it's down to about a quarter or just over under a quarter, 22%. But still, it's an appreciable proportion, and it means these women did not need treatment. They've had treatment unnecessarily. Unfortunately, at this moment in time, we don't have the tests that would enable us to determine if this is one of these very slow-growing cancers or a cancer that really does need treatment. So everyone is treated for safety. But we've now shown that a number of women are being treated unnecessarily.
Experts say that the kind of cancers that tend to strike women who are in their 40s, that this type is often very aggressive. So is it important for that reason that doctors catch these diseases early with a mammogram?
Well, that's one of the interesting things about screening that people don't understand. Screening, in effect, because it finds cancers early, maybe, but in a relatively short proportion of their natural history, it really doesn't affect the nature of the cancer. If the cancer is of a type which, in fact, it will grow rapidly and cause metastases and potentially death, finding a cancer early, our study confirms, makes no difference to that that natural history, that expectation. What is making a difference and what is critical, and this is getting better all the time, and it was much better in our study than it was in the earlier studies in Sweden or the first study in New York, is the treatment in addition to surgery which is given for breast cancer.
And we'll have to pause right there as we talk with Dr. Anthony Miller, Professor Emeritus in Epidemiology at the University of Toronto. We're continuing our conversation right now about a new study on mammograms with Dr. Anthony Miller, Professor Emeritus in Epidemiology at the University of Toronto.
The findings, regular mammograms, especially from ages 40 to 60, I think it was, aren't as helpful as people may have thought previously, and we want to hear from you what you think of this. Is this going to change your plans to get annual mammograms? Why or why not? Are you a breast cancer survivor yourself? How was it detected? Do you think people should go in for regular screenings? And if you are a healthcare professional, what do you make of this ongoing debate? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
Dr. Miller, the American College of Radiology had some criticism about these findings, and they charged that you used secondhand mammography equipment, and that may have, I guess, influenced the results. What's your response to that?
Well, it's not true. We use secondhand mammography equipment. I have no idea where that came from. We were very careful in our selection of centers for the study. In the various places where the study was done, they were all state-of-the-art centers. We used, of course, the mammography that was available during the 1980s, but we used the standard criteria and the standard views that were then proposed, accepted in North America. We used radiologists. Radiologists were part of the study. They came to meetings. We discussed the findings. We had a reference radiologist. All the mammography machines were inspected by our reference physicist, who made sure that they did not produce too much radiation. That was a great controversy at that time. People were very worried about the amount of radiation from mammography. And actually, the American College of Radiology is well aware of this. We've reported this again and again. We've commented. We've responded to these comments before. It's really very disappointing that they don't move on and look at the actual findings and the implications for their discipline. But they want to continue chasing after shadows, a number of which will do harm to women because they don't need to be found, and women will be overtreated.
I want to go to our callers now. We have Catherine on the line from Cable. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. So I was wondering the guest's opinion on people who are considered like high risk for breast cancer. So when I was about 18 years old, I was told that by the time I was 25, I should be regularly screened every year, actually, with a mammogram, because both of my grandmothers had breast cancer. One died from it, and the other one had to have both the breasts removed. And then my aunt, my maternal aunt, also died from colon cancer, which I have some people have associated with the high risk of breast cancer. And so I was just wondering if those folks were included in this study, or if that was a consideration at all either.
Okay, thank you so much, Catherine. So Catherine wondering about genetic tendencies and high risk cases. What about that?
Well, we recruited women who were at average risk of breast cancer. We did collect information on family history. We did collect information on other risk factors. including smoking, which has turned out to be a risk factor for breast cancer. But we did not make any difference in terms of what we offered women in terms of risk factors. This was because at that time, there wasn't sufficient evidence to suggest that mammography would be valuable in women at high risk of breast cancer. I think now it's recognized that if you're going to screen women who are at high risk of breast cancer by virtue of family history, and I note that your caller has grandmothers who have breast cancer, but not, I gather, mothers or aunts, so that means she's not in a very high-risk group, but people in a high-risk group, particularly people who are found to be carriers of the breast cancer genes, BRCA1 or BRCA2, then in general, screening is not recommended because the experience has been this does not really help women. Other approaches to management of their risk is necessary, including, if necessary, bilateral mastectomy and or removal of the ovaries. So I think this is a particularly specialized issue, and we did not set out to evaluate that in our study.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling, Catherine. Hope that helped. And let's move to Rhonda in Baraboo. Hi, Rhonda.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. What's your question?
Hi. I actually am one of those cases that my breast cancer was found by mammography. My tumor was only 1.7 centimeters and was against my chest wall. I couldn't feel it. My doctor couldn't feel it. It showed up on a routine mammogram at age 44. I have no family history, absolutely none of breast cancer. So, and it was triple negative breast cancer. So I'm really grateful for mammogram.
Okay, thank you, Rhonda. And I'm glad that it was a success story for you. Dr. Miller, what about, I guess that's, Rhonda is the classic case, I think, that you'll probably be hearing when people object to this. What about these cancers that aren't detectable by a manual exam that would have gone undetected?
Well, it's not clear that they would have gone undetected. One of the things that we've learned as a result of the various studies that have been published since the first screening studies, which seem to show a benefit, is that because there is this, what we've described, overdiagnosis of breast cancer, our previous estimates of the length of time which mammography advances the diagnosis of breast cancer, which is about 4 years, in our case, when we made those estimates some years ago, are actually incorrect. Once you include the fact that some of the cancers would never have grown to become clinically relevant in a woman's lifetime, and we've estimated these are half of the cancers found by mammography which are not palpable, not detectable by a good breast examination, then you find that the lead time gained by mammography is much, much shorter, of the order of 1 year. And that actually will not change the natural history of breast cancer, because breast cancer is a long natural history and is unlikely to make much impact. The thing which benefits women with breast cancer is good treatment. And that's what was available for the women in our study. There's no financial barrier because of the Canadian healthcare system. And many of the investigators in our study had been participants in the trials which established the value of the adjuvant treatment, as we call it, chemotherapy and hormone therapy for breast cancer. So that the emphasis on mammography is understandable, but I'm afraid our study shows it was misplaced.
Now, when you talk about good treatment being key in the treatment of breast cancer, are you talking about things like the drug tamoxifen, which is something that is very effective and might mean that mammographies aren't as useful? Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
I'm talking about tamoxifen. I'm talking about chemotherapy. Now we are able to distinguish different types of breast cancer that we couldn't before. These are actually amenable to treatment with different drugs. And there is increasingly better treatment which is occurring.
Let's get in one more call. Holly joins us from Madison. Hi, Holly.
Hello. My question or comment for Dr. Miller is, does he propose ultrasound when warranted rather than mammography? I found my lump. Mammography was done on the same day ultrasound followed the mammography, and then right away they did a biopsy based on the two imaging procedures. And I was diagnosed with breast cancer and ultimately went through partial mastectomy and so on. My concern now is that I had calcifications recently discovered via mammography. And then they go on and they do further testing once that happens. So I will take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Holly. And Dr. Miller?
Well, if she's had calcifications found, that probably means that she has an area of in situ cancer. In our study, we did follow women with in situ cancer, and they seem to be a risk for breast cancer. So she has to be aware of the possibility that breast cancer has occurred. But the mere fact that you find calcifications doesn't necessarily mean you need to go through all sorts of other procedures, though I would recommend an ultrasound, make sure there isn't a mass, which should then be biopsied to make sure it's not cancer. So there are a number of things that should be done to find out whether this lady has cancer or not.
Okay, well, thank you, Holly. And in our last 30 seconds here, how do you hope this study changes the discussion about whether or not women should get mammograms?
I think it's changed. It's raising the issue back up to the stage where it needs to be for discussion. I understand, particularly that for women who had breast cancer detected as a result of mammography, it's difficult to accept that this may have been unnecessary. But I believe that we need to consider that possibility and try and adjust our approach to compensate for that, or to make allowance for that, or to make sure that women are not over-treated. We don't want women to receive treatment which is unnecessary.
Dr. Miller, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Anthony Miller, Professor Emeritus in Epidemiology at the University of Toronto. He's the lead author of a new study on the value of mammograms.
Well, when it comes to American industries that have been hit hardest over the years, the textile industry might be at the top of that list. Because of automation and cheap overseas labor, a lot of people over the years have pronounced the American textile industry as being dead or close to it.
But our next guest points out that in 2012, the U.S. textile industry actually generated $54 billion in shipments and employed about nearly a quarter of a million people, and businesses on the upswing, especially in southern states. But why?
Joining us now is Marcia Mercer. She's a journalist and columnist who writes about national affairs and politics. She recently explored the rebound of the U.S. textile industry for Stateline, the daily news service of the Pew Charitable Trusts. Marcia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, as we said, people have been writing off the textile industry for a long time, but we're seeing some strong numbers. What's behind this?
Well, there's several things. I think the South especially has been a good place for textiles for a long time, and since they lost a lot of their plants, they've been trying to find ways to recruit other companies to come in, and the surprising thing is that they have been able to bring in a lot of foreign mills now are starting to look at the United States to come to open and expand plants.
And is the foreign competition, the cheap labor overseas, not as competitive as it used to be?
Well, that's part of it. I think especially wages have gone up in China, so we actually are seeing some Chinese companies coming to the United States. But it's also that the United States has a lot better utilities. They have more reliable transportation. Those kinds of infrastructure things are become actually pretty helpful for these companies.
Someone in your piece refers to the movie Norma Rae and the textile industry jobs being very low paying, often very low skilled jobs, at least when you start. What do the jobs look like now in these new textile factories?
Well, they're totally different. I mean, the textile jobs are different. The plants are totally different. They're very high tech. And one of the people I talked to said Norma Rae would have trouble getting a job unless she wanted to sit at a computer. and you know, program the robots. I mean, it's really that different. And the plants are not dirty the way they were. They're very, very sparkly. And so the jobs pay much better. I think the average, now they don't pay as well as all manufacturing jobs, but the textile average wage in 2012 is about $37,900 compared with about $60,500 for all manufacturing jobs. They're a lot higher, though, than they were. They used to be pretty minimal-paying jobs, and now the skills do attract higher wages, too.
What kind of skill levels are we talking about? A lot of places are looking for jobs to replace those manufacturing jobs where maybe someone with a high school education could get that job. Is that the case for this comeback in the textile industry?
Not so much. I mean, well, you would need at least a high school education, and probably there are a lot of community colleges now that have training programs, and there are other training programs that would help you with the kinds of technology you would need to have. So it wouldn't be just, in the old days, yes, you could go. And in fact, sometimes didn't even have to finish high school. You could have a very good career in the mill, and it would be, you could raise a family, and it was terrific. But that's just not the case anymore. So you've got to have more education and more, just a more rounded, I think, education than you had before.
People have complained that it's tough to find things like T-shirts or other clothing made in the USA. What kind of products are being made in the USA at these mills? Are we talking clothing or what kind of textiles?
Well, they make a lot of things. I mean, you're right about this. Made in the USA is one of the reasons why more things are being made in the USA. I mean, people want to see that label. And Walmart, for example, has agreed to buy a lot of American products over the next 10 years. And one of the things they're buying is American towels and washcloths. So that's, the people are also buying, they want the T-shirts. Some of the T-shirts are being made here again. And some things are, there are a lot of things that you wouldn't even think of, household products, diapers, facial wipes, the Swiffer, the mop, you know, these kinds of things now they're non-wovens. They're not the traditional. The non-wovens are things that are more like felt. You know, they're fiber-based products that are compressed or heated or tangled. That's a huge new area for textiles.
Things like Swiffer are a household name. How about the companies that are opening these factories? Are they companies we've heard of?
Well, no, I don't think so. Some of them have not been in the United States before. So they are a Chinese company is coming. They're coming from all over, but there's the one Chinese company is going into Lancaster County, South Carolina, and they're gonna be making yarn. You know, so it's not some of this stuff is very not as household. You wouldn't see it in your house, but it'll be made into other products.
This is such a reversal of the trend. It seemed like textiles was one of the leading industries when it came to moving jobs to other countries. Is this a sign that other industries, you think, might follow suit?
Well, certainly we've already seen a lot of auto manufacturing move to this country. You know, of course, you see the foreign automakers in the South. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why the textiles have come back, because they're doing a lot of upholstery and other kinds of manufacturing for these car makers. But yeah, I think especially now that some of these communities have recruited these companies, and they're going to try to get more. So yeah, I think we'll see other kinds of industries coming, one would hope, into this area.
Marcia, thanks a lot for spending time with us today.
Oh, thanks. It was fun.
That was journalist and columnist Marcia Mercer. She joined with us to talk about a comeback in the United States textile industry.